Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout. And today we're talking to two local Otatahi writers of young adult fiction. Both have had great success with their former novels, and so they're back again. Mel Dixon with the second in her trilogy, and Heather McQuillan with another really absorbing and challenging story. And another local author, Otatahi funeral and wedding celebrant Chrissy Christensen, has put together a collection of memories, mementos of the death of a child in the words of their parents. Please say their name. Mementos of the death of a child in the words of their parents have been compiled into a book entitled Please Say Their Name by Otatahi marriage and funeral celebrant Chrissy Christensen. There are not just stories in this book, but are also a very useful guide to those who are supporting people in grief. Chrissy, what prompted the book?
I wrote the book when I realised how many of my friends and family had had a child die. All of the people in the book are people I know. Some of them I personally have taken their farewell ceremony for. And I was holding that a lot in my head and my heart. And I thought, I would really like other parents who are going through this to know that they're not alone, that at the time of death, there's this terrible loneliness of grief. And I can't take that away from anybody. But for them to feel that there is a normality in grief, and other people have felt it, and what they're going through is actually normal, I hoped would be helpful for them.
The title, Please Say Their Name, is absolutely vital. It just captures the fact that people need to talk about the child. They need to talk about the person who's died, and, you know, they need to be encouraged to do that, but also that supporters need to keep saying their name, don't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that some people felt the loneliness was more exaggerated because people didn't know what to say. So literally they felt people were turning away from them, were crossing the street, were not coming around, were not bringing up their child's name because they didn't want to upset them. And that was in the initial stages, but then they realised 5 years later it was still happening. And all of them told me many times, our child still lives in our hearts. Our child still lives in our memories, they are still with us, and we really don't want to feel like our child never existed. We want to feel like they are remembered in memories of other people, and other people have got heart memories and love for them as well.
Yes,
and so this came through with all of them saying that they found it much more comforting when people would bring up their names naturally, or even honour an anniversary of death or an anniversary of birth or a time that people had shared together, because the stories in the book are not just about children, they're about their child who may have been 53 years old. So there's different ages and stages that their child has died, depending on the circumstance.
Yes, I was going to bring that up. When we say a child has died, we often just think of children, of young children, but of course, you know, a 90-year-old can still have a child who is the child in their life. And tell me about the process of actually getting the people to put their stories down, did they tell them to you in some cases, or did they write them themselves?
It was a little bit mixed. It was a project I did at COVID. Some people I talked to over Zoom and wrote little bits and then sent it back to them, and they edited it and put things into their own words. Others I just talked to and said, would you like to write? And they free-flowed, wrote from their own hearts. I didn't give them very much more than saying, I would like to put some words together from various parents, and you write what you want to write and how it felt for you and what you would like to say. So I didn't have a plan to say, try and fill in this gap or that, or say what I want you to say. I gave them all free permission to write what they wanted to.
Yes, and I think that comes across, because all the stories are very heartfelt, but they're all very individual. There's no sense that they're writing to a particular format.
Yeah, but I didn't want a template. And because grief's not like that. Grief is 100% unique to everybody. And what one person had of a child dying of cancer would not be the story someone else had. So grief is unique even within a couple. Sometimes the husband is feeling a completely different way of reacting to what the mother was, and or the wife. So it was. I talked mainly to the women, but I gave quite a few of the dads permission to write. A lot of them felt they didn't have the words, and I think that this might be a little bit of a saga with New Zealanders, that the men would rather go out and ride bikes and splash in the waves and go to the gym and pound it out, and women need to talk it out. I'm just guessing. But, you know, we do grieve differently.
That's another point that I picked up. And I think I know that anyway, that... And that's what a lot of the people who are surrounding those in grief need to remember, that their own experience of grief or thoughts about how to do it are not necessarily going to be of help to those who are going through it, you know, the actual people who are grieving. So you do have to be careful what you say to people.
Yeah, I think that probably the worst line is to say, I know how you feel, because we don't know how they feel. Even for me, I've had over 30 of my friends and family have had a child die, and I would still never say that to them. It's not happened personally to me. I do not know how they feel and what's going on for them. But I know it's hard, and I am really wanting to hear their heart.
So the book has the first part, obviously, the mementos of the death of a child. The parents have written their own stories. But the second part of the book, you give some very helpful overviews, or I don't know if that's the right word to use, of, you know, how we see grief now. And it changes, really. I remember the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross stages of grief, and people, when it first came out, and people thought, this is the way to deal with it. But we're now thinking quite differently, aren't we?
Totally. And I think, again, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was not a model given to people who had someone die. It was given to the person. And so it was given for people who were in cancer care, palliative care, to say, these are some of the things that you may be going through. You might feel anger, you might feel shock, you might feel that you're going to bargain it out, you know, and that hopefully you will reach acceptance by the time you're facing your death. But then that got given the model to everybody to say, this is what you need to feel because you've had a loss. And I'm using that word loss very fluidly, because a loss is the word we use again because we're too scared to use the word death. We say you lost your child, and you didn't lose your child. No. You had your child die.
No.
You know?
I'm very...
So terminology is really important, and it's really, again, as I said, grief is so unique to how people grieve. There is no one way, so I don't want to say I've told people how you can grieve. There's a template on how to grieve. I don't want to ever say that either. I want to say understand grief may look or feel like some of these things. If you've got complicated grief because you've also had a job loss and you've had a been made redundant or something, and you've had a mother who's become very unwell with dementia, and you've had a child die, that is incredibly complicated. Your grief will feel very, very heavy.
I like the fact that you use the word death, because it's been a bugbear of mine for quite some time that people now talk about passing away, loss.
Absolutely, Norman. We have so many terminologies. People talking about walk over the rainbow bridge and plop their clogs, and there's just so many terminologies because we're too scared to use the word die and death. But that's what's happened. And once we start using it, then people can start to feel it hit heavier in their heart to say this really has happened.
So it's an incredibly useful guide to people whose child has died, but it's also an incredibly useful guide to those who are floundering around wondering how best to help people in grief. How can people...
I was going to say that's most of us, isn't it?
It is. Indeed. What I was going to ask, Chrissy, I was going to thank you for doing this work, because it's hard work for you, but so vital. How can people get a copy of this book?
So we've got it in Otatari Christchurch. We've got it at the University Bookshop and the Scorpio Bookshop. We have it in Unity Bookshops in Wellington and in the Women's Bookshop in Ponsonby. It's also in numerous libraries around the country, and if you go in and ask for it and they haven't got it, then Walker Books are being really helpful and they're putting it into libraries. So it's in various libraries throughout New Zealand. There's also an e-book on Amazon. Or people can get in touch with me and I can post them one. So there's lots of different ways to get in touch and to find it.
Yeah, that's great, Chrissy. That makes it very easy to go and look for. So if you do want a copy of the book to read from either bookshops online or at libraries, the book is called Please Say Their Name, and the author is Chrissy Christensen.
And that's Chrissy with a K.
Yes, indeed it is. Chrissy with a K and Christensen with a C.
Christensen with a C, yes.
Thank you for your time, Chrissy.
Thanks so much. I just think it's a book a lot of people say they don't want to read, and I think most people don't ever want this to happen. But if we can understand it with more supportiveness, love, generosity and grace, then we can help people who are trying to survive having had their child die.
Ngā mihi. It is a very, very useful and compassionate book. Thank you.
Thanks, Maureen.
My pleasure. And I'll let you know when it's going to air. And then
thanks so much.
It's a podcast and you can do a link to it.
Okay.
Cool.
Flick it out to me when you get it. That's
I will.
Great. And thanks for reading it. And thanks
no,
for giving
my
it
pleasure.
The time.
Yeah, no, my and, pleasure. You know. Yep.
I said to Mark, I should have had it on the stand beside Lucy Honey's
yes.
And Jake Bailey.
Yeah, indeed.
I said, we should have said to Penny, pull my book up.
Exactly.
But I wasn't quick enough to
no.
put it there with all the grieving books. But
no.
I thought, you know, it would be good to get it promoted through word somehow too, I think. Because
good.
we
Mementos of the death of a child, in the words of their parents, have been compiled into a book entitled Please Say Their Name by Ōtautahi marriage and funeral celebrant Chrissy Christensen. It's not just stories, but a very useful and compassionate guide to supporting those in grief through this traumatic time.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Mel Dixon is well known to Ōtautahi's writing community. She is a director and tutor of Hagley Writers Institute, lecturer of creative writing at Canterbury University. She's editor-in-chief of the local poetry and flash journal, Quick Brown Dog, among many other contributions to Te Ao Tuhituhiinga. She is an award-winning writer in short story, flash fiction, adult literary fiction and fantasy for young adults. She joins us this morning to talk about the second novel in her dystopian fantasy adventure trilogy for young adults, The Edge of Light. Launched last night at Scorpio Books, the second book, Miracle, When Faith is Lost, picks up Meryl's adventure where the dawning left her. Imprisoned, imperiled, and at sea. Tēnā koe, Mel. How lovely to have you on the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here.
It's very exciting for me. Mel's my tutor. I'm in year one of Hagley Writers this year, so I've got a little bit of awe going on.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, Mel. Your books are published as authored by an A.M. Dixon.
That's right.
But everyone knows you as Mel, so tell us about that decision.
Okay, so my first name is Anne, so I've always been known as Mel my whole life, but I've always had this kind of strange double identity. You know, when you go to the doctors, it's Anne Dixon. And I wanted to publish under a name that was gender non-specific.
Right.
I've heard a lot of talk about particularly boys, young boy readers, not picking up books by female authors. Okay. So I wanted a novel that could appeal to both boys and girls, and also with conversations with my publisher at One Tree, we both decided that going with A.M. Dixon would be a good way to go. So
cool.
Yes, that's where we've gone.
Cool.
The other thing it does is it slightly separates it from my adult writing. So again, a different name for a slightly different audience. Some of my adult writing I wouldn't want young people reading. So it just gives a little bit of distinction there as well.
Yeah. Great. Okay. Thank you for that. And listeners, I don't want to ruin your reading pleasure, so I will give zero spoilers for book two, but I am going to ask Mel to tell us first how Meryl got here. So if you're about to or have book one, The Dawning, on your shelf ready to read, maybe make a cup of tea or something now. So Mel, tell us The Dawning. How do we end up with Meryl starting here on The Miracle?
How do we end up with Meryl on the boat? Gosh, that's like the whole of book one, isn't it?
Just a quick run us through it.
So Meryl is a scientist who works in an area known as the Trees in Littleton. It's quite a controlled existence that they have. There's certain places she's allowed to go and certain places she isn't allowed to go. In this Littleton of the future, there are enormous covers across the whole sky, keeping the whole world in this constant kind of semi-darkness. If you think of a full moon night, that's about as light as it ever gets during the middle of the day. And there's a day when they announce that they're going to open the covers as an experiment. And Meryl decides that on this day she's going to go out of bounds. Part of it is for her own risk-taking, and part of it is a mission to go somewhere secret with Ren, who's the boy she's got a crush on. The two of them go out of bounds and have this amazing experience as the covers open. And during part of that, she finds a species of bird that has never been seen before. And Meryl is a bird scientist, and she's very excited about this and wants to do something about it. So she catches the bird, keeps it secret. But the authorities find out about this bird. Wren is expelled from the community, and it seems that that might be Meryl's fate as well. So Estelle persuades her to get on board the Miracle as a way out of being sent off, being expelled. It's a way that there's a potential hope for the future for Meryl. She doesn't feel like she has many other options.
Because being sent off seems like...
Being sent off is you're out in the ocean on a little boat by yourself. Presumably, you're not going to survive that experience.
Yeah. So this is a way for Meryl to... Meryl's story to keep...
To carry on,
In a believable fashion,
yes,
really.
Yeah. That's right. So she's persuaded to go onto the boat by Estelle, who's a young... who's been put in the position of voice of the child, so speaker for the children, for the community. She doesn't really want to be in that position. It's a position that only lasts 7 years. So Estelle is also looking to escape. So in a way, it's a bid for freedom for both of them.
For both of them. Freedom and a future for different than what's prescribed. So can the girl take on authority, galvanise a complacent population, and give the planet a brighter future? That's our plot for the trilogy.
That's a big question, isn't it?
Yeah. that's kind of what we're setting out to do here.
The big question is, there's quite a few big questions. How much impact can one person have?
Yeah.
How much agency can one person have, even when they feel powerless? Yeah. At the beginning of the first book, Estelle, who's the voice of the child, identifies Meryl as the one, as the person who's going to change things, which Meryl very much pushes back
in against. There's a kind of prophecy there,
yes,
that Estelle's
right.
referencing.
That's
yeah.
right. Which Meryl very much pushes back against. She doesn't think she's special. She doesn't think she's got much to contribute, really, to the world. But I suppose the whole trilogy is about how everybody has something to contribute, even if you think
you
haven't.
And could be the one.
And could make change in whatever way. Mm. And sometimes we're forced to make changes, even if we don't believe that's our destiny or whatever.
Yeah, and so... We're asking a lot, you're asking a lot of Meryl, but it feels like we're all asking a lot of our younger generation,
yep.
aren't we? And this book really kind of encapsulates some of that from a fictional narrative point of view. And as a mother, I know you must feel really passionately about that. Do you want to just talk a little bit about what that means to you, that what we're asking of our younger generation and how you feel about that?
Yeah, I think there is a lot asked of the younger generation, particularly when it comes to issues like climate change. Mm. You know, we're handing on to this generation at the moment, a planet where there have been massive changes, and massive changes that we've known about, certainly known about well from the 1980s, and yet seem to have done very little. And there seems to be a lot of pressure put on this generation to do things which... personally, I think is extremely unfair when they have no power, really, in order to make changes. Whereas there are people in our generation or older who actually do have the power to make changes and are choosing not to. So, yes, there is.
There's a grief for any author, I suppose, or a kind of a fear in writing dystopian fiction like this. You said last night, and I just want to kind of focus here on that young reader in the context of that kind of fear and anxiety for the future. You said last night at the launch that I was privileged to attend that your daughter was pretty much your target reader.
Yeah.
And you thanked her for her contribution to the group, which is lovely. So for people who haven't met Sasha?
Yeah, Sasha.
Describe the young person that you're aiming at for us and what you'd really love them to take out of the book.
Okay, so obviously writing for my daughter is because I know her so well.
Yeah.
So I know the ideas that are going to catch with her and the things she's going to be interested in. So I suppose I'm writing for a young person who is interested in the world, is interested in making a difference. Sasha has a very strong sense of social justice, of doing the right thing, of protecting the world in some shape or form. She and a friend wrote a song all about climate change when she was in primary school, when they made a music video. And, you know, so very much taking action in whatever way she can. But I think it's very hard for young people that age to do anything that makes a difference. Sure, you can write a song, but what change actually comes out of that? I love the fact that Sasha loves my books. I think that's the biggest buzz. And as I said at the launch last night, when we were on holiday, in Australia in January, we had a camper van and went around for a week. And over that week, she read the whole book and, you know, be busting to get back to the camper van to read. And, you know, in terms of giving you the tingles, it was like, oh, it was amazing. And provided some very good feedback. Yeah. You know, so Sasha read it, and Paula, who was also at the launch last night, read it in its very later draft stages. And both of them gave me some very, very useful feedback in order to then get it over the line.
Yeah. Cool. That's lovely. Because this book takes us through a part of Meryl's story where she has to toughen up a lot.
Yeah.
And also kind of learn to be more defiant.
Yeah.
To get on the front foot.
Yeah.
You don't make it easy for her at all. So can you tell us about what it feels like as an author to test your character like this, and how do you know how far you can push her? What's going to be authentic?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, what's going to be authentic? How far can you push your characters? I think, as I said last night, I think you have to be mean to your characters. You have to make bad things happen to them in order to see how they respond, in order to make them respond. It's not interesting reading if our characters don't rise to the challenge, right? Yeah. but there are a few times when, you know, writing that book, I've asked myself, have I pushed her into a corner too far? How is she going to get out of this? And at those times, I'll often left her in those places for days, weeks at a time to see how she's going to get through this, how she's going to get around this. And even at the end of The Miracle, there's some quite difficult situations she still needs to get herself out from. Without wanting to give the plot away too much, there are a couple of situations where I ummed and ahed about whether I was going to keep them in or not, or whether that was making life too hard for her after the end of the book. But I've got great faith in Meryl. And in her ability to
deal with
difficult situations and to, you know. And, of course, everything isn't going to be perfect at the end of the trilogy, you know, because that wouldn't be authentic, realistic. And there's nothing more annoying than a story that just ties up neatly at the end, right? So there are still going to be challenges for her.
Yeah, and we've got enough notes to let us kind of wonder which one of these things might stay unresolved.
Yeah.
So it's fascinatingly well done for a middle book. It has to do a lot of work, a middle book, doesn't it? You talked a bit about that as well. Do you want to say a bit more for the listeners?
The middle book I found particularly hard to write. The middle part of a novel. The first part is relatively easy because you've got all this fresh energy that you're pouring into this new story and it's all shiny and I've written the beginnings of lots of books, right? The endings kind of write themselves because you know what the resolution is. You know where it's going. Sorry, just knocked my glass of water there. So the endings kind of come out pretty quickly as well. But in the middle, there's all sorts of other stuff going on. So the middle, for me, particularly the middle of the middle book was particularly hard to write.
And when you talk about leaving Meryl in a difficult situation, you really did in the middle of this book, didn't you?
Yep.
She was left somewhere.
Yes.
And so that's a fascinating kind of device, I suppose, to deal with the problem of the middle.
Yeah.
It's a good book with some great twists. Thank you. She's left. As you've mentioned, we don't really come out in a much brighter place at this stage.
No.
but she's well tested, and she's got more resolve, and she's in a place where she's on her own front foot. you know. Yeah. So there's still a hell of a lot of work to do, but there's that critical difference between the beginning and the end, and that's really her character journey.
There's a character shift in the second book, particularly when she starts to feel empowered.
Yeah.
She starts to feel that she can actually make things change, make things different for herself.
Mm.
And that's crucial. That's crucial for the whole trilogy. That internal turning point for Meryl, when she discovers that she can do things, that she can do things herself, and that she is brave, and you know,
and it might come down to her on her own, you know, and she's really kind of working through that. So, how long do readers have to wait before we find out how Meryl gets on in this?
For the final book.
Yeah, I know. You've only just put this one out, but so it's not an unfair question.
No, it's a good question, and it's exactly the question that my editor, Christine Dale, asked. So the book went to the printers on Tuesday. It was a Tuesday morning, and that afternoon she emailed me saying, when's book three? Which I think is very valid. So I have a good first draft of book three.
Cool.
Yeah. I spent 2 weeks getting a first draft out on the page. In that 2 week slot, I think I wrote 40,000 words, which is unheard of. It's never happened to me before. It probably never happened again. But I've got a good first draft, so I know how Meryl is going to get from this place to the ending. So hopefully book three should be out next year.
Excellent. Oh, that's very exciting. We don't have time for notices about Quick Brown Dog, unfortunately, but I'll put some in our socials when I put it up. We have to wrap there, but thank you so much, Mel, for everything you do for the writing community and for this marvellous story. The book is The Miracle When Faith is Lost, Almost, I say almost, by A.M. Dixon, published by One Tree House and available online and at all good bookstores. Scorpio have a shelf full, so get stuck in.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Truth Needs No Colour is the title of Heather McQuillan's latest book. Heather has written a number of award-winning books for children and young people and is well known here in Otatahi for her work with young writers. She's the director of the Write On School, and she's also well known for all the flash fiction that she writes and does so well. Heather, this is a really compelling and confronting book for young adults. I was completely taken by it. And it's a story that is, you know, frighteningly relevant today, isn't it? I'm really interested in the origins of the story, because I know it's taken you a while to.
It has. It's been with me a long time, and Mariana, who's my main character, has been with me 13 years. So she started just as a scene I wrote in her voice. She arrived fully formed and in her voice told me the story of her 15th birthday. And the next, I didn't know what I had there on the page. Sometimes there was no plan of what that was going to become. And so the next day I sat down to start writing the next scene. But what happened was a year later, and I got the scene of her 16th birthday. And for me, it was a real puzzle, because I then had to go and figure out, how did she get there? What happened in that year to bring about that change? And that's an enormous change that has occurred for her. That's where it started. And I know a lot of people have said, oh, it is so relevant to today. And I think that I saw some of this coming. And it is politically really relevant to what's going on today with privatisation. As somebody said, it's a clarion call, but it's not where it started from 13 years ago, but it has come closer. And that's, I guess, a bit of the problem of writing dystopia. We don't want it to be true. We want it to stay in the fiction section.
Yes, you want it to be speculative, but not, as you say, not showing us a future that is frighteningly close. Well, tell us about Mariana into her 15th birthday. She's a wonderful character because she doesn't start off as your typical feisty, in-your-face person.
She started off in her very first drafts as being a bit of a complainer, a bit of a, that's just not fair. And I think I'd heard that from a number of young people that I've worked with. It's not fair. And in her case, it wasn't. But then it gets even more unfair and she starts to become aware of how unfair the situation is for her classmates and in particular one young man who she's quite attracted to, Feliki, who has been identified as someone to move between the school and the prison. So that idea of that school-to-prison pipeline in this case is the reality, because the company that runs the school also runs the prisons. And so they get more funding per prisoner than they do per student. So capitalism means they want to keep those prisons full. And so they target some of the students who are coming through the school to ensure they get there.
That's, you know, one of the facets of this story that is, as I say, so scary because, you know, we are looking at increasingly privatised public services like education and health, and we're looking at the rise of charter schools. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for a lot of these students in your book, there seems to be no way out once they're on a particular path. And Mariana, as you say in the beginning, she feels like she's got to keep her mouth shut and not speak the truth.
That's absolutely right. It's too hard. There are certain reasons why it would put her family members and the people she loves in danger. So she does keep quiet to start with, and she tries to say something, and she's looking to other people to say something, and the adults around fail. So in the end, she has to decide to speak up. When she does, unfortunately, when she does first speak up, she's angry. And so it all comes out wrong and she makes things worse. She has another chance to speak up and tell the truth. And in that hearing that she's in at that point, that truth is twisted and turned around on her. And so even though she's spoken, she still doesn't feel like she's been able to have her say.
Truth is the word that comes through over and over again. Mm. And the title is, in fact, it's a Shakespearean quote.
It is a Shakespearean quote, yes. It was from one of the sonnets.
And it's about truth not needing to, you know, standing for itself, really, not needing or shouldn't need anything else to go with it.
Truth should be clear. But we, as we know, and having experienced the last 10, 15 years, I guess, of social media and the twisting of truth and what's been going on all around the world, we don't know what to believe now. Things that are called truth are actually lies. So it's that whole twisting of words, and that definitely came in through the use and the misuse of quotes that the school uses, the misuse of positive psychology in order to place the blame on the students. So they are told to have grit. And if they don't have grit, then it's their fault. It's not the fact that they're living in poverty or they're disabled in some way or that the whole society is against them. Oh, you've got to have grit and it's your fault if you don't. So that really patriarchal attitude comes through the school and that twisting of words. But the kids who survive, the ones who lift up and who Mariana recognises as exemplifying what the school is saying they want, are the kids who are the most put down. So
it's a very recognisable world In fact, again, that's a chilling thing about it, because you've set it down here in the South Island, a South Island that's been ravaged by a major cyclone. And, you know, we have to understand that it's climate change that has brought this about. But again, you know, we've all, young people, have seen the devastation that climate change is wreaking on our country, on the world. So it's a fine line, isn't it? Not to be too terrifying in
this.
Well,
one of the, where it started was actually post-earthquakes. And with me reading and feeling really concerned about what was happening with education and a fear that what had happened with Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, where all of the public schools were closed and turned into charter schools, that may be what the government was wanting to do here in Christchurch. That didn't come about then. It's now back on the agenda again. But that, you're interesting that you say, yes, it's based here in Christchurch, and I, over that 13 years that it's developed, it's reset twice. And I felt at one point I couldn't write it based in Christchurch. It was still too close to those earthquake years. So when it got its final rewrite, I moved it back to where I had originally placed it here in Christchurch, set into the future and now set against a second catastrophe, where the whole of the South Island has been affected. The transport systems are all broken down again. And the government has decided that it's no longer financially viable to manage the South Island. And that's when Carapace, the evil corporation, steps in and seemed to be very good and very helpful to start with. And everybody's really appreciative of what they do initially. But they have an agenda.
And of course, you know, I don't know whether it's compulsory to make sure that a novel like this ends on a hopeful thing, or is it something?
It's something I was very clear about as I started writing, that there needed to be hope, that there needed to be optimism within the story. And I have read a lot of dystopian stories, and at the end you feel like, oh, well, I may as well just give up. That's not the point of this book. So there is hope, and there is the fact that there are people, good people, who step in. And that was something that we were very aware of after the earthquakes, and it was something we talked with the children about, that good people came. Look at all the people who stepped up and helped us. We didn't turn into some anarchic society. There weren't people running around with guns and all sorts of things afterwards. People actually stepped up, community pulled together. And so that was really important for that to happen in the story and for it to finish with the sense of hope that voices, young people's voices, everybody's voices, made a difference in there. One of the other key characters, and I want to just mention this, is Inanna. Unbeknownst to people at the beginning, Nana is very instrumental. She has a stitching group, an applique, where they're making their quilts, and undercover of that are also politically active. So not just the youth, but I think the older people, and we're seeing that around the world now, as who's turning up to some of the protests in the UK and the US, the older people, the old hippies, they were called the other day, I saw by somebody.
Yes. But they're showing up again.
Showing up again, know how to do this. So it's everybody is able to have find a voice and use that voice in some way.
Yes, that is important, isn't it? Because, you know, one of the first people that Mariana realises is helping and invested in the children is a school teacher.
Yes, the lovely Mr. Knight, aptly named the Knight in Shining Armour. And he is a very sarcastic maths teacher, but he loves those kids and he wants to help those kids and support them. He's very aware of the system he's being forced to work with, and so he's there to support. Yes, whereas some of the other teachers, really, they're just as afraid and running for their lives as the children are. Mm.
You work a lot with young people and young writers, so you must get a sense of the kind of books that they're looking for, that they're needing. What are you hearing from them?
Well, a lot of the young people I work with, the teenagers who are writing fantasy. So that's not what this is.
No.
This is very grounded in reality. But they also have a strong voice politically. And I think that they want to be heard and they need to be heard. They have things to say and they're certainly worth listening to. What they want. And it's around justice and it's around truth, and they are incredibly accepting of difference and of each other. They look at each other and the others in the class who might be a little bit quirky, and they admire it. And I think that's wonderful. So, yeah, there are quite a number of young people of various diverse interests in the book who are able to come together and be part of the whole thing.
Yes, and, you know, I can't emphasise enough how important it is for there to be books like this out there. I wish I'd had books like this when I had a lot of wonderful books, but they weren't grounded in you know, these kind of realities, shall I say. They were, you know, well, once you got on to Animal Farm and 1984 and things like that, sure.
I'm hoping that it's not just young people who pick up the book and read it. I think for adults, the adults who have fed back to me have thoroughly enjoyed and been engrossed in the book. They've said it's really impossible to put down. They couldn't have to wait up at night before they could turn off the light, finish the book and turn off the light. So I think I'd love adults to read it. I'd love teachers to read it, people who are involved with young people and with education, because it is, as one of my readers said, it's a clarion call that we have to speak up now before we head down this path of privatisation, of a narrowed curriculum, of a test-based, assessment-based curriculum that they're locked into. And the other thing that this future is, they're totally locked into their career paths from the age of 14, 15. There's no moving between the streams, and we're starting to hear that being talked about with the changes to our education policies here in New Zealand. So read it, teachers read it, kids read it, and yes, everybody, use your voice in the way that you can. Mariana, through her artwork, could be through joining a group, it could be speaking out on social media, wherever, but we need to make sure that we don't go down this path.
Well, thank you for writing the book, Heather, and giving voice to all those ideas and aspirations and whatever, you know, because you're right.
No, I don't want that to all sound really heavy.
No, it's
because
not.
It's not a heavy read, but it is all in there, yeah.
Well, what I was going to say is the beauty of a novel like this is that put in fictional form and done well, as you have, those messages come through without being, you know, heavy-handed.
Yeah, yeah. So I've tried not to do that.
Yeah.
And I just was worried what I just said sounded heavy-handed, but
no, well, as I say,
no, it's
you
a
know,
story.
That is
they're real
the
people.
Beauty of fiction. You can tell the story and let the readers pick all those things up and run with them, which I hope they will. So thank you. The book is called Truth Needs No Colour. It's by Heather McQuillan and it's published by Cloud Ink Press.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books. next Tuesday on Plains Media.